it all began with music. It was as if the whole world stopped. One moment Sophie was on her way to the dance floor, and in an instant she was face down, unable to move. All she could see was a hazy, eerie orange glow, and a horrible stench burned in her nostrils. Her ears rang painfully as she attempted to look upwards. She was relieved that the roof hadn't collapsed, but then realized she couldn't remember if there had been a roof at all. She thought she could see clouds and for an instant felt that she may be on her way to her maker. Amidst the smoke and dust, her ears full of an agonizing humming sound, she drifted in and out of consciousness. Long moments passed before she came to and began to fathom what was happening. She tried hard to think, but no thought stayed with her for longer than a few confused seconds. She thought she could hear sirens. Was she dreaming? Was this really happening? Everything changed in that split second. Until a few moments before, she had been exultant and unbelievably happy. In fact, for the entire 2 weeks, her family had been here together. All three of them had been elated. She had done well in her exams, and this holiday to Bali was her reward. An excellent violinist, she had been accepted to study at Sydney's Conservatorium of Music. Her parents had been delighted, but knew she would have to leave their home at Stanwell Park, a coastal village south of Sydney. This holiday in Bali was a special time for them. They had been out to dinner, then went to the crowded Sari Club in Kuta. As they headed for the dance floor, they dodged hordes of people, mostly backpackers with drinks in hand, parting hard, some trying to make their way back from the bar, others content just to stand and be in the way. Sophie grinned at her parents, knowing they were putting up with the noise and chaos for her benefit. In order to prevent getting separated, they held hands. Her father, Peter, found a way through the wall of people and tucked Sophie behind him. In turn, she tucked her mother, Shelley, who wore a new dress, in vibrant blue, bought the day before in one of the markets. Hand in hand, giggling, laughing, euphoric, so wonderfully content, and although drenched in perspiration, they were enjoying the absolute pinnacle of Balinese bliss when the walls came down. None of them made it to the dance floor. The explosion was horrendous, so loud that Sophie's hearing was instantly muffled. Time seemed to slow right down. The entire world turned orange, the brightest orange Sophie had ever seen. The club was instantly unrecognizable as the walls collapsed upon the patrons, crushing many of those who had survived the blast. People lay trapped beneath the rubble. As the dust settled, rivulets of blood ran across the floor, combining with food and dismembered body parts. More explosions followed, and Sophie, dazed, thought that she must be in a war zone. Did the big booms mean they were on the receiving end of some sort of attack, perhaps from the air? The blast put her in a place beyond any terror she had ever felt before. She couldn't fathom what was happening. This was a nightmare. Long moments passed, filled with moans and screams, sirens and shouts. She tried to move but couldn't. There was a warmth in her groin that soon became an intense burning sensation. She tried again but was unable to budge. Who had she been here with? Why was she here? She drifted in and out of consciousness for what felt like hours. During one of her semi-lucid periods, she felt an enormous weight lift from her legs, but the pain she then endured was so great that she again lost consciousness. She drifted deeper and deeper into a dream world like no other she had ever visited. Was this a precursor to death? The next time she awoke, she found herself clawing at rubble. Slowly and laboriously, she dragged herself forward, but a bloodied half-torso blocked her way. There were no legs to this body, but the brilliant blue it was wearing seemed familiar. Everywhere there were arms with no body, torsos with no legs. The bodies were all black, no distinction now between what once had been white skin and what had been brown. She pushed some of these burned body parts aside but struggled to pull herself over others. Large wooden splinters and shards of glass sliced and cut her hands. She couldn't feel her legs at all. The pain in her lower back, her neck and her head was unbearable, and amidst this bloody mess she drifted off again. To those out on the street, the club was now totally unrecognizable, a burning mess. It was a chaotic scene to the visitors who came from everywhere within minutes of the explosion, but also to the locals, for whom this was their home, the place where hundreds of them worked, where they and their families had businesses and spent every hour of the day and much of the night too. Quaint little businesses of only a few square meters of floor space, adorned with the bright colors so prevalent throughout Asia, and large, ostentatious businesses too, shops and pubs and clubs that employed an array of hard-working locals, each and every building in the vicinity reduced to rubble in one terrifying instant. There had been no warning, no time to run. And then it happened again, and for many of the people who came to help and for the bystanders too, that was the end. Early in the night it had all been so different, music from all corners of the street, the ever-present blasting of horns from mopeds and vehicles of all descriptions, flashing lights, laughter, busied conversations. It was a colorful and joyous world of holidaymakers. Days before, Sophie and her family were experiencing the holiday of a lifetime. None of them could ever have imagined that something so horrific was on the agenda for their vacation destination. Sophie was considered by many as somewhat of a prodigy. She was about to embark upon a course with a great deal of potential. Sydney's famous Conservatorium of Music is the dream of many aspiring musicians. For Sophie, it was to be reality. She had already received accolades from all quarters, a dozen concerts behind her, but most importantly the love of a mother and father who adored their only daughter and who were willing to do anything for her. 2 weeks earlier, the adventure began on the south coast of New South Wales, at Stanwell Park, a place where hang gliders for 2 decades and more had colored the sky as they dropped gently toward terra firma. As a young girl, Sophie used to practice her violin and marvel at the way in which these highly proficient sportsmen and women maneuvered their craft upon the updrafts and slowly, sometimes very slowly, came back to earth. She often got distracted by their gentle play among the clouds, but she adored the distraction. Unbeknownst to them, she would play music and imagine them dancing in the sky. She composed her early musical pieces just for them sometimes, and nobody but Sophie knew. She would play vibrant music one moment and placid the next, depending on the maneuver and the way in which a particular hang glider was descending. At the age of 18, she had a wonderful young life already, and her parents considered that the holiday to Bali was the perfect reward for her exceptionally good exam results. They planned the holiday for months, but nobody ever dreamt that it would end like this. Months passed before Sophie started to make sense of what had happened. She had spent weeks in the Balinese hospital where she was taken when finally the rescue team at the Sari Club sifted through the mangled and burnt debris and discovered she was alive. Sometime in the weeks that followed, she had been told of her parents' death. The news was so distressing that she instantly withdrew to a place deep within her being. None of the doctors, not the Australian specialists, nor the local medicos, felt it wise to consider anything but an induced coma while her torn, burnt, and broken body attempted to heal itself. It was considered that to move her to Perth or Darwin, like so many of the other victims, was unwise. Sophie's condition too precarious. But after 5 weeks she was repatriated, aboard a flight from Denpasar to Darwin, and with the assistance of a medical crew trained in such rescues, Sophie left the holiday isle without even knowing. Another 2 months passed before she was taken off the drip and woken from her induced state. She was pale and near lifeless and struggled to eat the small amounts of food offered to her. No longer she was a vibrant, spirited, energetic young woman on the threshold of beginning an exciting life of musical studies. Instead, she was morose and deeply depressed, unable to concentrate, let alone think of anything positive. friends visited, as did her grandfather, although for him, in his 80s, it was an enormous effort just to get to the airport, let alone the flight and staying in a city he didn't know, making his way daily to a hospital by taxi in the tropical heat. Neither he nor the friends could lift Sophie from the depths of depression into which she had so suddenly been catapulted. Eventually, however, progress was made, but not without the concerted effort of many of the medical team. At 6 months to the day from that horrendous night at the Surrey Club, Sophie was moved again, this time closer to her old home, to a rehabilitation center in the leafy northern suburbs of Sydney. But it was a further 8 months before she was able to go home. Her grandfather had been visiting regularly after her arrival in Sydney, and it was to his South Coast home that Sophie went. He had a farm near Bermagui and a house with few steps. As Sophie was now in a wheelchair, paralyzed from the waist down, this was a far more suitable house. Her old family home of several levels and steps everywhere was totally unsuitable. Her mother used to say, "The stairs will keep us young, your father and me. Climbing up and down is good for the bones." But it certainly wasn't good for a wheelchair. So to her grandfather's home she went. Being a bush carpenter, her grandfather knocked up a few ramps where they were needed, taking it easy so as not to overexert himself, and together they began a new life. Sophie's grandmother had died a few years before, and so Albie, as he was known to the locals, was happy to assist in any way he could. Sophie had always reminded him of his wife, so it was a comforting union. The two of them planted vegetables, pruned the fruit trees, and played cribbage. But the violin was not even spoken about. Then, one morning, after an ABC radio program on which the violin was featured, Albert brought out his treasured violin, the instrument that had so impressed Sophie from an early age, and which was the catalyst in getting her moving along a path toward playing the instrument at the young age of 7. After playing just one piece, the third movement of Brahms' violin concerto in D major, he could see on her face that the time was right. He chose the piece because it was one of his favorites. When he finished, he admitted something to his only granddaughter. "Before you were born, I played that piece for you while you were in your mother's womb."
"Mum told me that you played violin for me quite often."
"I certainly did, mostly Bach and Beethoven, as these were your mother's favorites. The piece I just played was my favorite."
"I think I would like to play," Sophie admitted.
"I'll go and get your violin," her grandfather offered, overjoyed that the time had come. By the end of the morning, they had played all Sophie's own favorites: Chasson by Bach, Mendelssohn Violin Concerto in E minor, Paganini's 24 Caprices, and the piece she played for her entry into the conservatorium, Sad Romance by Tao Wen Shan. She played with all the superb depths and feeling which had made her so accomplished at such a young age. Sophie's life changed dramatically that day. The weeks ahead were full of nothing but playing music, even experimenting with new styles and modern pieces. In time, she started to go out, venturing into town with her grandfather for a little shopping, the occasional coffee, and on one occasion to the pub. "I love the view across the surf to Mondromedary," she told her grandfather as she sipped her favorite drink, soda water with a dash of chili wine. It was at the pub that she met a friend who would become closer than Sophie had ever allowed to a non-family member to become. They became soulmates within days of meeting. His name was Benji, short for Benjamin, and he was in Bermagui to finish his thesis on the use of children as soldiers in war. Together they researched atrocities few Australians knew about, and Sophie discovered the enormous number of countries which abduct children to fight adult wars. She had found something truly worthwhile to become involved in and realized what her direction in life could be. The conversations with Benjamin were intense, and her interest in helping him with his thesis drew them closer than either of them thought would happen. By the time he left town, they were truly in love. "I will come back as soon as I submit my thesis," he told her, and true to his word, he did. Within a month, he received the news everyone who knew him had expected. He had been successful in obtaining his PhD, his work being so thorough and concise. "I'm going to Africa," he told Sophie. "Will you join me?" And that was it. By year's end, she was in Sierra Leone doing something that no one, not even Albert, her grandfather, thought she could do. Together with Benjamin and a team of medicos and sports aficionados, they were building the most progressive rehabilitation center for child soldiers ever devised. Within 6 months, there were classrooms, playing fields, gardens of herbs and vegetables, and fruit trees by the hundred that had been planted. Most importantly for Sophie, though, was that she had a music class. With a donation of a dozen old violins from Australia, she was bringing a new and unique musical style to West Africans. The smiles on the faces of her students and the intense manner in which they were so keen to learn said it all.